This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. At this very moment, many millions of people around the world are hungry, and dangerously so. People are struggling with food insecurity in places such as Gaza, Sudan, Nigeria, and Haiti. A United Nations-backed organization last month officially declared that a famine is taking place in Gaza City. And in Haiti alone, the UN estimates more than 5 million people, that's more than half of the nation's population, are experiencing acute food insecurity. Some approaches to addressing such hunger are working, and one of them has deep roots here in St. Louis. Meds and Food for Kids was founded in 2003 by pediatrician Dr. Patricia Wolf. The organization has treated more than 1 million malnourished children in Haiti with locally produced, ready-to-use therapeutic foods. It also trains Haitian farmers, supports sustainable food systems, and creates local economic opportunities. This month, Meds and Food for Kids is hosting Zero Hunger 2025, Doing What Works. The event will feature a keynote address from Ambassador Erthurin Cousin, the former executive director of the United Nations World Food Program and current CEO and managing director of the Food Systems for the Future Institute. She served as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations Agencies for Food and Agriculture in Rome during President Obama's first term, and she joins us now. Ambassador Cousin, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
We're also joined by Chris Green, the CEO of Meds and Food for Kids. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Ambassador Cousin, I mentioned a few places in that introduction where there are very serious issues of hunger being experienced. So for people who do not follow global hunger closely, can you paint us a picture of the scale of food insecurity today?
Well, thank you for having me as part of this conversation. And let me say that times are tough, particularly for children across the globe today. The challenge of food insecurity and acute hunger are continuing to increase, with over 300 million people globally requiring food assistance. What we're seeing is not just that the number of people who are hungry, but that hunger, particularly acute hunger, is being driven by conflict and climate. And the challenge is that we do not have the access to the capital that is necessary to support the responses that are required. In 2024, the UN had requested 56 billion dollars in support of challenges, and less than half of that was funded, the lowest ratio of need to funding in a decade. And it's not even in places like Haiti and Sudan. We're seeing significantly underfunded responses from the international community to support the acute hunger needs of the population.
That hunger, you've mentioned now Sudan and Haiti. Is that where hunger is most acute right now? And are there forces that are particular to those places that are driving those crises?
Well, Sudan is the number one humanitarian crisis in the world as we speak. The challenge in Sudan is not only is there underfunding, but there's lack of access by the humanitarian community. You noted in your introduction that the United Nations formally declared a famine in northern Gaza. The challenge there is not funding. When the conflict itself and the lack of access by humanitarians is the challenge. The UN, and I've spoken with Cindy McCain, the head of the World Food Program, they have received the financial resources that are necessary. Unfortunately, they lack the access to provide the food that is required. And what is driving the hunger there is the challenge of security for humanitarians performing the work and the ability to bring the food across the border into the area where it's necessary. Mm-hmm. In a country like Haiti, it is the challenge again of underfunding, and in some of the communities there, the challenge is also lack of access because of the gang violence and the insecurity in those communities.
So as we're having this conversation, Ambassador, I feel like we need to acknowledge changes in the United States' positioning in the world. And to be more specific, when President Trump came into office in January, his administration dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development. And on July 1st, USAID was officially shut down. Broadly speaking, what has the effect of all of that been in the work to address hunger globally?
Goes back to that question that, or that statement that I made about funding and the inability of the humanitarian community to provide the support that is required because of the lack of funding. Historically, the United States has been the most generous donor in most of the humanitarian crises that have occurred across the globe. When I led the World Food Program, the United States was my largest donor. And the executive director, McCain, has been required to reduce her staff by almost 40% and to cut rations across the world because of lack of access to the capital that would normally be received from the United States.
Mm-hmm. If we take a step back and think about what the funding that you're talking about having been lost, what it pays for, what it goes toward, and ideas that people have about hunger. I think many people think of hunger as a shortage of food. And you have also talked about access. Can you explain, Ambassador, how that's the case? You know, can you provide an example of the way that lack of funding does become this issue that is felt not merely as a shortage of food, but of access?
The challenge when we talk about lack of funding, the funding supports the purchase of the food that is required for distribution. The funding supports the transportation and distribution of that food. The funding supports not just the distribution of that food, but the work that is necessary to organize the communities for the distribution of that food. And when the funding is cut, that requires the administrators of those programs to then proportionally cut all of the services that are necessary, whether it's that transportation, it's that the purchase of the food itself, it's the staff on the ground that's necessary to support the population in need. And as I said, it's the food itself. If you don't have the financial resources, you cannot perform the work that is required to support the response in an acute hunger situation. We can have a very different conversation about a place like Haiti, where you have the opportunity to invest in smallholder farmers and production of food that would provide the ability for the community to build the resilience that is necessary for them to feed themselves. Mm-hmm. And again, catalyzing that work does require capital. And that capital comes from governments, and for organizations like Food and Meds for Kids, it also comes from donors and institutions that support the work that is necessary for local action on the ground. Mm-hmm. But in acute situations, I must be very clear, where those situations that hunger is driven by the lack of access because of conflict, that even where there is where the financial resources exist, that you cannot perform the work that is necessary to deliver the food that is required.
Mm-hmm. Now, to bring in then a conversation about work that does happen on the ground. Chris, I'd like to hear about the history of meds and food for kids. We mentioned in the introduction that it started in St. Louis in 2003 and was founded by Dr. Patricia Wolf. Can you give us a Cliff's Notes version of how and why Meds and Food for Kids got started?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dr. Wolf began traveling to Haiti, goodness, probably 30 years ago now, as a pediatrician, and initially on short trips, and just saw the vast amount of malnutrition that was present, and just feel like she had to do something because she could. And I think it's a narrative throughout the whole story of MFK, is that really ordinary people, when they set their minds to doing something and to making change and are persistent, it is amazing to see what happens over time. So a little over 20 years ago, Meds and Food for Kids is founded by Dr. Wolf. At that point in time, she's still coming in and out of the country while raising her family and managing her practice in St. Louis. Over time, she continues really to raise awareness, build support. In 2010, 2011, we built a factory that produces ready-to-use therapeutic and supplementary foods in Haiti. We began during this time to also work with local farmers and partnerships with universities in Missouri, but all over the U.S., and really and kind of take a multi-pronged approach in really saying, okay, well, we have these acute problems today that need to be addressed, but that we also need to look at what are the underlying causes of these problems that we're looking at? What are the root causes? And sort of taking a holistic approach. Now, over 20 years later, we are operating in Haiti in the midst of all these challenges. We have a staff of almost 90 that are in Haiti, all local staff, and we're operating not just the production of ready-to-use therapeutic foods, but also in building capacity in agriculture, in the food systems, looking at how do we address some of the broader access challenges that Ambassador Cousin spoke about. So it's really quite an amazing story to see how one person, just with the right heart and the right persistent energy over time, has really helped build such an amazing organization doing amazing work in Haiti.
And when you say that you've built capacity in Haiti, what is a concrete example of that? Can you describe what a person might see if they were to visit and see what is happening?
Absolutely. I can think of several great examples. I would say one with our agricultural programs. You know, through partnerships, we have trained thousands of farmers at this point on best practices in having to, whether it be improving their planting and harvesting, post-harvesting techniques, helping to introduce more drought or disease-resistant crop varieties. So these are things that they're not just a one-off intervention, right? They're really about long-term solutions. They're about building systems that lead to more nutritious local foods, a greater supply of those foods. If you go and visit our facility in Cap Haitian, you'll see a state-of-the-art manufacturing plant where we're able to produce this. This is, as I mentioned, all run by our local staff. And this is, it's an amazing feat that is so important, not just in meeting those local needs, but also when you're sort of setting the tone for what can be done. When you think about the impact within a country and within those communities, when this level of complex food processing is successfully happening, and those needs are being met by people's neighbors, right, within the local community. So these are examples, I think, of capacity where you're able to, whether it be critical food systems or very complex manufacturing, now the capacity to operate successfully is fully developed within Haiti.
And Chris, what is the food? You've used the term ready-to-use therapeutic foods, also referred to as RUTF. What is the food itself?
Yeah, ready-to-use therapeutic food is a it's a peanut. I like to describe it as a peanut paste, and it's a highly nutritious peanut paste that is made using a combinations of vitamins and minerals, proteins, protein calories, and really it's designed to meet all of the critical needs of a child suffering from severe acute malnutrition. And so this is it comes in a small sachet. I like to think of it about the size of an energy bar. And a child would eat 2 to 3 of these a day over the course of about 8 weeks and go from being a severely malnourished baby to a healthy little human being. So it's really, it's a miracle product. And we make that in Haiti in our facility, as well as several other supplements, really looking at not just addressing the needs of severely acute malnourished children, but also how do we address the needs of the mothers, the expecting mothers? How do we address the needs of school children that may not have access to other meals or other foods? How do we help meet those nutritional needs and work towards not just addressing severe acute malnutrition through these products, but also preventing it?
Mm-hmm. Ambassador
Cousin, if I could come in here very quickly, I'd like to add on to why the program that was just described is so important. With overseas development assistance faltering, making the international pipeline for support that a country, particularly like Haiti, has depended upon for decades, localization is no longer optional. It's essential to support the farmers that can build the develop the products that can then provide for the food assistance support that the community requires is the type of intervention that will allow for that resilience that we all talk about but too often don't deliver to actually occur.
Ambassador, when it comes to scaling up efforts, if we've seen that the model that Meds and Food for Kids is using is a model that's effective, how difficult is it to scale up so that this approach can be applied elsewhere?
Well, we're seeing the Meds for Kids is a great example, but across the globe, localization of programs and new businesses, and many times these are businesses that are operated by the small farmers and co-ops and community, communities as well as individuals, that create the foods, the support, the transportation, providing the refrigeration. All of this is beginning to come online in different places across the globe. Meds and Food for Kids is just one good example of it. But what is missing and what is required is the capital for scale of these programs.
Chris, you have seen Meds and Food for Kids work on the ground in Haiti. And what Ambassador Cousin has described, you have seen some of that yourself. Can you share a story about a child or a family whose lives you've seen transformed by the work of your organization?
Absolutely. I'll share the first time that I encountered just how powerful it can be when you treat a child who's severely malnourished. At the time, I was living in the city of Gonaïves in Haiti, and my wife was operating a primary care clinic there in a very impoverished area. And a little child had come into the clinic, and this child was actually a little bit older than the typical range. We really target 6 months to 2 years of age, but in the community my wife was working in, sometimes they would have children that come in a little older. And so this child was between 3 and 4 and was not walking and was not talking. And my wife began to give them Plumpy Nut, this ready-to-use therapeutic food that Meds and Food for Kids makes. And it was amazing to see that it was about 4 or 5 weeks into the process. I remember this little kid coming in, and they were speaking and walking. And it absolutely blew my mind. And this was right at the beginning when I was first living in Haiti, and I actually hadn't started working for Meds and Food for Kids yet. And I just remember thinking, it's unbelievable that a product like this exists, that in just 4 or 5 weeks, you can see this much change in a little human being. And it really began to drive home for me at that time just how much and how crucial proper nutrition is for children, especially in those early years. And it's something I don't think we conceptually often know in the States, but I don't think we really think about the impact of it, that, you know, in those first 1,000 days up to that roughly that second birthday, you know, the estimates are that a child's brain is forming as much as 1 million synaptic connections a second. After that second birthday, after that first 1,000 days, our brain begins to shift into what is called like a pruning and a strengthening phase, right? Where it's looking at those connections that exist and it's saying, okay, what are the connections that I want to strengthen? And what are the connections that maybe aren't being utilized the same way? And so I'm going to prune those back so I can dedicate resources to these other areas. Now that in and of itself is amazing. But when you really dive into it at a deeper level, we can see how critical it is, because when we lack nutrition, when we experience this in a prolonged sense, when a child becomes severely malnourished, they become lethargic, right? They don't have the energy. So we're not just talking about the quality of those connections that are being made, but we're actually talking about how they're engaging with their world in a way that stimulates that brain development, in a way that helps form those connections after their second birthday.
Ambassador Cousin, what we are hearing about Meds and Food for Kids is a point of light. It is an encouraging example of what can work when people are working together and thinking about doing so in a more systemic fashion. But when it comes to hunger and the hunger crisis on the global scale, is there some way that you have hope that in a place like Gaza City that doesn't have the infrastructure there, that something can be put in place and that we can hear more of the kinds of stories that Chris has shared about what he's seen in Haiti?
What gives me hope is that we're sharing this conversation today and you have listeners who didn't turn off their radio. Because what is required in order for us to scale up the access that you've just described that is necessary in a place like northern Gaza or in Sudan is the public will, the political will, to support the ceasefire and the humanitarian safeguards that are necessary for those on the ground to perform the required work. And too often we turn away, and as a result, the decisions that are necessary, the political decisions that are necessary to support that access, are not made. But when people, voters, citizens, begin to raise their voices of concern and demonstrate that there is the public will to support the political action, that gives me hope.
Ambassador Erthrin Cousin is the former executive director of the United Nations World Food Program. From 2009 to 2012, she served as U.S. ambassador to the UN agencies for food and agriculture in Rome, and is now the CEO and managing director of the nonprofit Food Systems for the Future. Chris Green is CEO of the St. Louis-based nonprofit Meds and Food for Kids. Thank you both for joining us today. Zero Hunger 2025, Doing What Works, hosted by Meds and Food for Kids, takes place at the courses at Forest Park on September 18th. For more information, visit mfkhaiti.org/zerohunger.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.